something like that, but I lost track. I majored in religion as an undergraduate at Holden College, went to Dartmouth Medical School, and then as a midlife crisis, went back for a master's in theology, which led to me serving on the ethics committee of our organization, which has about 350 doctors. It's a large multi-specialty group in Everett, Washington. And as a result of that, I ended up heading up a project for our clinic that we're in the midst of that's focused on end-of-life care in the United States. And I've been presenting a lot for physicians. This is very fun for me because I've taken what I'm doing and I'm flipping it. And a lot of my work with physicians is helping them learn how to talk about end-of-life with their patients and why they should do that. And I'm kind of excited about this chance to educate or even learn from you guys about end of life, because obviously I'm kind of immersed in the medical part, but I've flipped it because there's just this lack of conversation on both sides, and we have a big problem in our country as a result of that. So let me just get this going. And I have a PowerPoint because I just have too much to say. Oh, what just happened? I'm not a technology person, so username or password is incorrect. Let's try that again.
But you're amusing password.
Yeah, well, you know, have to keep it easy. Okay, so here we go. So I'm just going to start, and that's supposed to be big.
Go up to slideshow.
Slideshow, thank you.
From beginning.
From beginning. So glad you know what you're doing. Okay. These are just some very sobering statistics about aging in the United States, but the baby boomer population, of which I am one, is getting older really, really fast. And so we have a major crisis in our country of aging and dying. 78 million Americans will turn 65 this year in 2011. At age 35, our cells are no longer maturing. In fact, everything starts going downhill at age 35, which is very, very sobering. 98% of people are dead by the age of 85, a range of like 82 to 88. And the dementia rate at the age of 85 is 50% in our population. Only 2% of the population experiences sudden death. So chances are almost everyone in this room is not going to die quickly. We're going to die slowly. So I wanted to, I put therefore go hiking, you know. But I wanted you, this is a big group, but if we could just throw out what some of you would say the tasks of dying are. What would you say are the tasks of dying? To die well. How do you die well?
Prepare a will.
Prepare a will. Have a will, okay?
Live well.
Live well.
Forgive people?
Forgive.
Healthcare directive.
Have a healthcare directive. Does everybody know what a healthcare directive is? If not, you will learn about you. Healthcare directive. Okay? What other tasks of dying well do you think of?
Acceptance.
Acceptance. Any other thoughts?
Discussion with family.
Discussion with family. Yeah. Family. You had your hand?
Well, if you're terminally ill, you can get yourself into the hospice program before they get to the
hospice, yeah. Okay. These are all really good. There are many, many elements to dying well, but one of them, I think, that sort of entails many of these things is time. Having time to know that you are dying. So that you can have time to forgive, or have time with family, or have time to grieve, or have a living will. So one of the ethical issues about dying in the United States is that we are taking time away from the process for people, and I'll get into that. I have pictures, Brad, I'm gonna go throughout here. So this is sort of a public crisis that's hitting the media. This is from the Rodale Press, saying, if a loved one is ill, raise the issue of hospice. Basically, the gist of the article is your doctor won't do it if you don't. Bill Moyers in 2001 did this about end of life on our own terms, Moyers on Dying. It aired the first time, 58 million people watched it. Actually, it was 98 million, and it had a 58.8% higher rating than most PBS primetime shows. Because there's really a sense in our country that we're not dying well. 7 out of 10 Americans would prefer to die at home, but actually only 25% of Americans die at home. When they questioned people who had chronic illnesses and said, would you rather be in the hospital or be at home? And 80% said, I'd much rather be at home. But in reality, we're dying in hospitals, we're dying in intensive care units. The rates of hospitalization at the end of life are increasing. This is a Dartmouth Atlas study that just came out. The length of stay in intensive care units is increasing at the end of life. So what this means is that it's actually hard to die at home and it's easier to be hospitalized in the United States at the end of life. So there's many ethical issues with this. One is people don't have time to grieve. We know that intensive care unit deaths have a higher rate of stress on the part of people who are dying. They've actually done studies, which makes sense. In the intensive care unit, you're hooked up to tubes. You can't communicate frequently. You have tubes down your throat. And also, interestingly, the bereavement periods for loved ones are longer for persons who die in the intensive care unit because they don't have time to talk with them and communicate. So there's an ethical issue there just about how we're dying and how we process dying and how our loved ones process dying. But there's another big issue ethically, and that is the economics of death and dying in the United States. This is Medicare costs and Medicaid costs, and you can see they are going up dramatically. These go up through 2008, and they've just done nothing but continue to increase. When you look at Medicare costs, 25% of the budget is spent on the last year of life, and 40% of that is spent in the last 30 days. We know that in America, the average American sees 10 different doctors in their last 6 months of life. It's just like this huge absorption of cost that we're having at this end of life. And that's all rising. It's continuing to rise. We haven't reversed this trend. Now, I can tell you in Everett, where I work, the public health department just closed our TB clinics. We had clinics that treated people who came in with, usually immigrants coming into the United States with tuberculosis. Now, we had to close them due to economics. And this is just a really fundamental example of this shifting. The dollars are shifted to the end of life, but there's kids who aren't getting immunized. So there's an ethical issue here, I think, that we're dealing with about where do we put our money because we have a finite amount of it. And generally, it's the marginalized who aren't getting it. So that's a problem. So costs were a third less for patients who had end-of-life conversations with their doctors. They actually did a study. The interesting thing is that end-of-life conversations, not even having a will or a healthcare directive, but having had the conversation, improved the quality of death. They showed that if you had the conversation, you were more likely to have a death that was in the process satisfying to the patient and to the family. So here's just some leading causes of death. I threw these out here. And I wanted to point out a few things. One is that there's some things here, for instance, stroke. My mother's had two small strokes. Her doctor has never mentioned that that's a risk for anything. But if you look at it, it's the third leading cause of death, which means if you or a loved one has had a small stroke, it's probably a good idea to address these issues. COPD is another one. Many, many Americans can suffer if it's chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or emphysema, depending on how you look at it, chronic bronchitis. That's the fourth leading cause of death, and most dogs. So there's a lot of things that we don't think of as related to death and dying, but they really are. You know, heart disease and cancer, everybody sort of goes, oh no. But we, basically living is a terminal state. We're all gonna die of something. So I just want you to think for a minute, and we can write some things down if you're willing to throw them out. What are you afraid of when it comes to your own dying process? What scares you about dying? Who said?
Pain.
Pain. It's a big one.
Leaving people behind.
Leaving people behind. Yep. What?
A prolonged vegetative state.
Yeah, prolonged, without knowing what's going on, right?
Yep.
Being away from your support network or those that you love.
Being away from your support, yeah. Which is, the intensive care unit really is, makes it harder to be with loved ones.
What else? Any other thoughts?
Yeah. Dying without reconciling with people.
Dying without lack of reconciliation, that's a great one. So I think there are spiritual tasks of dying. I think reconciliation is a big one, forgiveness, being forgiven. Many people need to do some kind of confession. So if you, about every 2 months, I pick up the paper and I'll open it up, and for the last few years, it'll be an 82-year-old World War II vet or survivor who is sort of confessing his role in the Holocaust or confessing, you know, you read these things where people, a few years ago, a guy was confessing that he made up the Loch Ness Monster, that they, remember this, when he was a teenager, they created this, and he was near death, and he decided he needed to really tell the public. I see that often, I think that's an important part of sort of unloading yourself in preparation for what comes next. So that was a really good point. So you look, statistically, what people want in a survey, they want to avoid suffering. These are things you guys are talking about. They want to be with family. They want to have touch, which is really important. Be mentally aware and not be a burden to others. I have an issue with this. I think this is too American, personally. I think that we are meant to die in community, and we are meant to help one another die well. And so I don't want to be a burden to my kids, but I want them to participate in taking care of me like I did with my dad and I will with my mom when she dies. So I think we need to really question whether being a burden is a bad thing or whether it's what we're called to do for one another.
Is that another way of saying I am afraid that they might resent this situation?
It could be. I mean, I guess it might be different for different people, right?
There's one thing about your children taking care of you from a physiologic standpoint, but also if you don't have the income or financial resources, you're draining their financial resources.
So
and that's part of the burden to others. That
yes.
Would be a concern.
That makes sense to me. Interestingly, the best way to alleviate that is hospice.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Okay. So now I'm going to talk about advanced directives, a healthcare directive. There's, depending on where you're from, it's called different things. But there's sort of a spectrum, and again, this varies depending on where you live, but basic disease-specific care planning is really a conversation. And that's really what we need to have more of with our doctors, and our doctors need to have more. You know, we all need to be having that. Then you have the, it shows up okay, the healthcare directive, which you can do with or without your lawyer. You don't have to have a lawyer to fill out a healthcare directive. And that's the specifics of what do I want to have done to me and how much do I want to have done to me. And then, and I don't know if Minnesota has a Have you guys ever heard of a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment? They have them in, it's required in, it's in Wisconsin, Arizona, Washington State. This is a fabulous thing that goes with you. It's basically assigned by your physician, but it basically says exactly what you want done, and it goes with you from your house to the emergency room, to the nursing home. It's taped on the refrigerator, so my mom has one because she does not want to be resuscitated. And if she drops and the medics come, they read it and they will not put her on, they won't resuscitate her and put her on a ventilator, which is really a lovely document. And I don't know about this.
There's a do not resuscitate order, but I don't know why that's what Pulse does in Minnesota.
That's state-based, so our Pulse goes into more than just DNR, which, and that's called a no-code status. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you have one on like a green sheet you can tape to your refrigerator.
Yeah, this is supposed to have, I was in the hospice program, worked in the program, and that is something everybody has on their refrigerator, their patient on hospice program.
Okay, so, and you're in Minnesota?
Yeah.
So usually that means anyone in Minnesota can do that. So my mom's perfectly healthy, but she's 82 and she doesn't ever want to be in the hospital, and so she has one. So the real key, though, overall, is the conversation, because everything changes, and it changes as we get older. It changes depending on our diagnosis. It changes depending on our family, you know. And so the conversation needs to be ongoing, and it needs to be with our families and our medical providers. This is a fancy graph, but really it shows you a few statistics. One is that, as I mentioned earlier, 2% of people die like this, where they have a great quality of life, and then boom, they die. Mm-hmm. So most of us die like this. Mm-hmm. Slowly, we go in the hospital, we come out, we get a little better, something else happens, we get sick, we come. That's the decline that most of us experience over time. And somewhere in there, we have a line that we think of as quality of life. So as an example, I had a 98-year-old patient recently who I was asking her what her quality of life, what quality of life was for her, and she said it was to drink tea and go to the casino with her nephew Larry. And if she couldn't do those two things, she would rather die. And actually, she died about a week ago, a week and a half ago. I had another 94-year-old who said her quality of life for her was to be social. And if she couldn't be social, then she'd rather not be alive. But at some point, it's good for your family to know what that is for you. Because your family is frequently in a position of having to decide what's going to happen to you. And they need to be in agreement about, well, Mom always said she never wanted to be kept alive if she couldn't communicate with us. And we know that, and so let's pull the plug. But it's as doctors, what we see a lot, and this is really hard, is you see a family where there's a child who lives in the area and knows the parents well, or even two children, and then there's somebody from far away who comes flying in and says, no, no, no.
Yeah.
It's a terrible situation for us. And so it's really important that everybody's on the same page and that it's really clear. So again, at this point where quality of life crosses your decline, that's really what I call end of life. And the conversation hopefully starts before that, you know? And hopefully I think a lot before that. Now I want to talk a little bit about why doctors struggle with talking about this stuff. First of all, we hate it when patients say, doctor, what do you think? And the reason we hate it is because we're feeling like the ball is being put totally in our court. And as one doctor said to me, he's an oncologist, he has cancer care, and he said, that's the existential question that's based on the patient's value system that I can't answer. Meaning, what do you think I should do, doctor? That's a really tough question as a doctor. When it comes to death and dying, this is your story. And you guys are the heroes, and you guys are the only ones who know what it is you want. And you're the only ones who know what's important to you. And what really doesn't matter is how long you're going to live. It really doesn't matter. What matters is what you value. And a lot of people, I think, get focused on, well, how long? And doctors feel very, you know, it's like, this is a really hard question to answer. Because usually we don't really know, or if we really know, we're afraid to say. And that's because this is Joseph Campbell, who's a lovely man who did a lot of work with Jungian. I might not be able to read that, I'll read it to you. But he defined a hero. He said, a hero is any male or female who leaves the world of his or her everyday life to undergo a journey to a special world where challenges and fears are overcome in order to secure a reward, special knowledge, a healing potion, which is then shared with other members of the hero's community. He looked at myth and mythology and came up with this definition of a hero. And when you read that, that describes what doctors do. We leave the world of our everyday life, we go to this journey to a special world, the mystery of medical school, we go through these challenges, we stay up all night, we, you know, all the things we do, and we secure a reward, which is this special knowledge that we bring back to the community. Now, a lot of doctors, I share this with doctors, because a lot of doctors don't realize that that's what they want to be the hero. They want to fix it. And they're trained to be the hero, and they're supposed to be the hero. And so when they can't be the hero, they don't know what to do. They literally don't know what to do. So they don't know how to say, I'm sorry. There's nothing more I can do for you, but let's talk about how you want this to go from here and what's important to you. Doctors aren't good at that. That's part of the training I'm doing with doctors. But the real issue here is understanding that you, this is really about you. And it's really not about the disease anymore. And that you are the hero because you're the one taking the journey into the next life. And so you just have to sort of set aside that whole tendency we have to want to know how long and how, when, and where, and just kind of say what's important to me. But this is why doctors have a hard time. As soon as they can't fix it, they feel like they're a failure. And believe it or not, doctors feel like they're failures when their patients die, which is nuts, right? Because we're all going to die. But they feel like failures, and so it's like this huge issue of struggling with our profession, and we have so much technology we can throw at people. This is another one of my issues with end of life, is I think it's a little bit like Pavlov's dog, where the doctor can say, well, we have this one more thing that we do. As long as the doctor can keep saying, I can do one more thing, frequently he or she will not bring up death and dying. And the patients frequently glom onto that one more thing. Well, if I do this, well, if I do this. So instead of addressing the umbrella issue, which is eventually your disease is going to kill you, everybody's looking at the next carrot, the doctor and the patient. It's not a healthy system. And it's because we have so much we can just keep doing, which also entails spending money, obviously, which, you know, there's a lot. But. Okay, so I'm briefly going to go over these are your basic choices. There's big choices, but CPR is the NOCO DNR thing. That's when we compress your chest and we shock your heart. Only 5 to 10% of people survive it, and the reality is when you are older and your kidneys aren't good and your lungs aren't good, you almost never come out as good as you were before, but you might have some cracked ribs and some difficulty thinking because your brain wasn't perfused well. And so CPR is great if you're young, you know, and you can bounce back. And that's an important thing. As you get older, personally, I don't recommend it. artificial ventilation, the problem with being intubated as you're older, when your lungs aren't healthy, is you can become dependent on the ventilator and never come off it. And the problem with that is then your family has to make that decision. And that's very difficult. I've been on a ventilator. I had open heart surgery when I was 36, and I woke up on a ventilator. And I do not want to die on one, ever. I just don't want to die on a ventilator. You can't speak, you know, in terms of that whole time with your loved ones. So ventilators are great, again, if it's a temporary thing and it's reversible and you've got underlying good, decent lungs and you haven't been going downhill, ventilators are great. This is a tough one, artificial fluids and nutrition. A lot of people think, well, I'll just put in an IV and get some fluid or put down a feeding tube. Many times in the hospital, doctors are very quick to put down feeding tubes, frequently without a discussion. What happens is the family has to decide to pull it out. And then the family feels like they're starving their father or their mother or their sister or their brother, taking away their food. This is a really tough thing. It gets back to that vegetative state. And at what point do we start from the, like, again, my mother, who would be up here hiking if she could, said she didn't want this either. You know, just don't keep me alive. This is a tougher one. Feeding tubes go through the nose, they cause soreness, they're irritating. They can stay in there for a very long time. They can put PEG tubes in that feed people for a very long time. So it gets back to this quality of life issue. Some people, quality of life is eating, and they say, if I can't eat, then forget it. Talked about that. Antibiotics, we frequently will give, you know, for pneumonia or urinary tract infection, antibiotics. This is on our physician's orders for life-sustaining treatment and many healthcare directives. We used to call pneumonia the old man's friend because pneumonia is a very painless way to die. And we treat it now because everybody thinks that antibiotics is not very invasive. But there might be a point where even antibiotics you might want to say no to. Infection is actually, I mean, I hate to sound like this, but it's true. It's like, you know, is actually a relatively good way to die. Your kidneys shut down, your potassium goes up, and your heart stops. It's actually what Kevorkian did to kill people, is similar to what infection can do. The issue is being comfortable. But so for a 98-year-old who's not doing well, totally reasonable to say, let's just not do anything. And we are in the position of God. This is something I learned long ago when I was working with one of my first families who was trying to make decisions about a dying relative in the hospital. I realized they were in the position that God used to be in. You know, my uncle died in his 90s about 10 years ago. He was an internist, and when he was a resident and people were dying, he played his guitar for them. He stayed up all night playing songs for them. When I was a resident, we spent the whole time trying to keep him alive with machines. You know, and talking with family members about what's going to happen next. It's just this huge shift in our society. So, remember, no code, no breathing machine, no feeding tube, never means no care. Care is always possible, even if cure is not. So, I want to talk a little bit, and some of you mentioned hospice. I want to talk about palliative care. How many of you have heard of palliative care? Oh, a lot of you. Can anyone describe it? It's kind of a funny concept. A lot of doctors don't understand it.
Just keeping the patient comfortable as they progress toward death. And being around with the family. Meeting, you know, basic needs or wishes.
Yes, and palliative care actually is also there for people who aren't dying. It can be that you're having a difficult go with cancer. You're not sure if you want to continue treatment. Palliative care, the palliative care doctors focus on pain management, symptom control, nausea, vomiting, breathing, pain, and keep people comfortable. And they're really much more effective at it than most of the rest of us doctors are. Because that's what they do. And palliative care can be just a wayside and then you can get better, or it can be a stepping stone to hospice. And not all institutions have it, but it's becoming more and more common nationwide. Hospice, on the other hand, is common everywhere. In the United States, what's very interesting is that whether or not hospice is used depends not on anything except for the availability of high-tech medicine. So they've done, Dartmouth has done this great nationwide study that just came out. In the areas that have hospitals and ICUs and cancer treatment centers available to them, people are admitted and die in the hospital and the ICU. In the rural areas, people have a much higher rate of dying in hospice. So it's better to die rural. but you don't have to be nearly dead. Your doctor has to think, at least in Washington State, that you have about 6 months to live. However, hospice can be renewed. There are people who've been on hospice for 2 years. You can be walking, talking, and driving and be on hospice. The average length of stay on hospice in our current county is 14 days, which is tragic. It used to be about a week, and we've been working on it. But really, the average length of stay should be 3 to 6 months. You know, if we really want to do this well, we know that people live longer on hospice. Really, really great study. The average length of life was 29 days longer for people on hospice than people who went in and out of the hospital. Why do you think that would be? Any thoughts on that?
Going into a hospital is the potential for picking up infections or complications.
Infection exposure, yep.
You're on your home turf. You're with your family.
Yep, home turf.
When you're going through the hospital stuff, your focus is continuing life. And when you're out of that mode and you're, say, on a hospice program, you're living your life, and it may be shorter, but you're living your life.
Yeah, quality of life is better on hospice, therefore people live longer. Mm-hmm. Pain management is better on hospice. People have less pain than going in and out of the hospital. The other thing we forget is that hospital treatments are very invasive. You know, what we do to people is really remarkably invasive, and more invasive the more technology we have. My dad had the craziest surgery 6 months before he died that I wouldn't have done anything to stop because it was so ridiculous. But because we can do it, and because he was a military man and he said yes to his doctors no matter what they said, didn't matter what I said. So he went through this horrible experience, you know, and he would have been better off on hospice and lived longer. So interestingly, it's, oh yes.
Would you just say very specifically what hospice means and what happens to families that engage in this, which happened. I had a very good experience with my mother's death last year.
Would you like to share that? That'd be great.
No, just I didn't realize that, for one thing, it's kind of an insurance category, mm-hmm. Okay, which I don't think everyone realizes, and that the kind of support that we provided by a hospice association specifically, and what is and is not expected of families.
Okay, so I don't know. Hospice, first of all, is a fully covered benefit of Medicare. And it covers things that regular Medicare doesn't, including hospital beds, depends, diapers, chaplaincy, home visits from social workers. At least in Washington, now state, it varies from program to program. Hospice programs are local, but our local hospice provides a pain packet and teaches the family how to use it so the family can manage their loved one's pain. It doesn't provide 24-hour nursing care, but it provides support. And hospices are required to have at least, I think it's 5% of their staff as volunteers. Hospice volunteers are remarkable people who come in frequently when someone is actively dying. They will do a prolonged vigil with the family.
They'll bathe.
Oh yes, bathing.
They
right.
bathe. And, they provide. You know, tell you how to do things in general,
yes.
Like that.
Yes,
which is very helpful. All kinds of little helpful services.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a remarkable thing. And the other thing is that it's fully covered. And so it really relieves that financial burden.
And what it basically means is that you're not going to seek other kinds of treatment, right?
Now, interestingly, in the Midwest, Aetna did this amazing study where they allowed patients to enroll in hospice and continue to get medical care. It turned out that in that group, more patients chose hospice earlier. And so the hope is that insurance companies will begin to provide simultaneous benefits. But right now, you're right, except you're in hospice for your diagnosis, say pancreatic cancer. But say you also have diabetes or high blood pressure, you can still go to your hospital, or your, excuse me, your doctor under regular Medicare for all of those things. You can actively still see your doctor and have it covered for other things. Isn't that interesting? It's just a lot of, yeah.
My brother-in-law in North Carolina just died, and he was in a hospice facility. They were going to come to the home, but the family was not able, because he was a big man, they were not able to give him any kind of care. But this facility was wonderful, and my sister was able to stay in the room, and they had like a little kitchen, so they could eat food. But it was a wonderful experience for them. And he wasn't given it. This was like, he was there 3 weeks.
And not all communities have that. We tried to open one in our town and it folded. We're going to try again. But so at this point, hospice is only in the home in our county. But yeah. So I was going to say that we know that spirituality correlates with increased use of hospice. Basically, I think people with an active spiritual life are probably a little less afraid to die. People I see who really want everything done all the way to the very end usually have a reason. They're afraid to die. They're holding on to something they haven't let go of. They think they've done some major sin. They believe in hell. They think they're going there. There's lots of things, but I think one of the tasks of dying is to come to peace with God. And in my opinion, I think we will meet him, and to prepare ourselves to meet him. So let's see, I covered the polls. So you must talk to your doctor, because your doctor's going to guide your care. And you must tell them, turns out only 25% of the time do doctors know when their patients have a living will or a health care directive. So you've got to tell your doctor, and you've got to tell them probably more than once. You've got to bring a copy to them. You've got to say, this is what's important to me, doctor. You've got to talk with your loved ones, because they need to know, because they might be in a position of making decisions for you. You've got to think about it ahead of time, in America especially, because it's hard to die well. And you've got to do it regularly, and I don't think you're ever too young to do it. If you look at Karen Ann Quinlan or these other really tough cases, they were young people. So the five wishes is a document that we are using in our institution. It was actually created by a guy who was the lawyer for Mother Teresa for 12 years, and he worked in her AIDS and hospice homes in Washington, D.C. And this is, you can order it, and you can view it online. And I would have brought copies. I didn't know I was actually giving this talk until I got here, so I didn't bring copies. But it goes into spiritual care. It goes into things like it details, I want to be touched. I want music. I want my loved ones to know that I'm okay with dying. It gives you all these choices. So it covers the spiritual, the physical. It is a legal document. You can use it as your advance directive. It's just a great, great document. It's used all over the nation. It's really, really good. Some other resources. This is a book that's available on Amazon called The Handbook for Mortals. This book is amazing. It even includes the dying of children down here, dying suddenly. So if you have a loved one who dies suddenly and you're in grief, on point four, helping family and loved ones, that's if you're dying. It's just a really good book about coping with all kind of aspects of death and dying. Another fun resource, which I did with my mom a few weeks ago, Go Wish Cards, which you can also order online, is a game you can play. And it has 30 choices. And you pile them up. These 10 are most important. These 10 don't matter at all. and these 10 or so. So when I did it with my mom, one of them was, I want to keep my sense of humor. That was in her top 10. I had no idea that that was important to her. You know, there's lots of things in there that helps you sort out. It's really great for discussion. It can also help. I've had people call me with situations where they couldn't get their parent to talk about it. There was an issue between a husband and wife, and they're trying to figure out how to get the conversation going, and this is one possibility because it's sort of a game. So I wanted to close. Well, first, any comments or anything? I just have something I want to read, but comments about all this, yeah.
I'm a hospital chaplain.
Oh.
And I've worked a lot with patients and their families at end of life. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is or how it is to talk with your spouse, your children, your parents, whoever. Because it's different, anyone having to make the decision to remove respirator or put in a feeding tube or whatever, it's, I think, one of the hardest decisions I see people have to make. If you've had a discussion with that person, it seems to mean so much more to say, well, Joan, we talked about this and this is what she would have wanted. And because it's very hard often for the families to give, they feel like they were giving up. And I often say, for you to do what Joan wants is probably the biggest expression of love that you could do for her, because it's what she wants and it's not what you want, because you don't want her to go. So if you're able to have that conversation, it just makes it so much easier for your family. So much easier. Not that it's ever easy, but it does make it, you know, part of that story of their death and what went around with that. Because a lot of people, you know, the last few hours and days of someone's life become a very big part of that person's story in that family, and the better it can go, and the less tension among family members, and I mean, there's a, you know, a lot usually goes on, so the more everyone's on the same page, the better.
And even if you think there's not going to be tension, it's surprising what comes up. It's better just to talk, put it out there for your family, because that is something we struggle with at our end. Yeah.
Sometimes the suggestions have been made, because families are so spread, but when they come together at Christmas or Thanksgiving, you maybe get out the go-wish cards and play a game. But to involve your younger family members as well, that's when you sit. You get to a point where it's almost too late to play that game. And you really need to start pretty early.
Yeah, I think that's true too. Yeah.
Where's that go through shared again?
Online, it's through a California group called CODA Alliance, but if you just put in Go Wish, Go Wish cards, you'll find it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you maybe expand a little bit on this conversation with physician, and it's easy to understand what we should converse with family about, but I certainly don't have the depth of experience as a hospital chaplain, but I have pastored some cases like this. And too frequently, who is your physician? The people you may be dealing with medically in the last stages of your life you've never seen before.
Which has changed.
And
of course,
what do you talk with them about? I mean, all you want is medical information.
So this is really hard. So I was visiting a kid who actually had an overdose in the hospital just a few weeks ago. And at midnight, this doctor walks in and says, I'm your doctor for the next 12 hours, and then I'll be leaving in the morning. And I'm just thinking, man, that's different from when I, you know, Abraham Lincoln. But when I was, you know, before hospitalist, I took care of them all the way through. So that's a problem, because when you have this rotating cast of doctors in the hospital, you have to be very clear about what you want, unless your institution, some hospitals, especially if you live in La Crosse, Wisconsin, they will know. The Gunderson Health Clinic is the best in the nation, and they will know. But other than that, you might have to say to each doctor, I don't want to be intubated, I don't want a feeding tube. I mean, it is literally that bad in some places. You have to advocate for yourself right now, and that's a problem. The other thing I see is my generation, our parents are dying, and all of us doctors are going, this is wrong, this isn't happening, we've got to change this. But the younger doctors coming through, their parents aren't dying yet. And so I think there's a difference there in the receptivity. Now, I could be wrong, because I think younger doctors are trained better in communication and lots of things, but that's just been an observation, because a lot of us older doctors are kind of recognizing we have a crisis. So,
do you think there's a difference between academic hospitals and the propensity to keep doing it?
Well, the Dartmouth study looked at that. The academic centers were more invasive, definitely, generally speaking.
One thing, when you're talking to doctors with a loved one in the hospital and they're proposing a treatment, ask them what are the possible side effects, or what is this going to give my loved one down the line. Now I knew a man who had prostate cancer and he had radiation. Well, it just completely ruined his whole lower digestive tract. I mean, he was in agony, you know. So, and he goes, if I had known this is what might have happened, I wouldn't have done it. So it's always good to know if you're suggesting things is to find out what it means.
That's a very, very good point, because a lot of times doctors don't want to talk about all the downside.
Right.
That was true with my dad. It was really a struggle. I had to tell him the downside, all of which he experienced. But that's a tough one. There is a question I put up here in terms of talking to your doctor. If you really want to figure out how bad off you are, the way to ask your doctor without making your doctor feel really on the spot is what I call the surprise question. Would you be surprised if I were dead in, and then you can pick, 2 years, 12 months, 6 months, 3 months? Because then the doctor doesn't have to be a scientist and say, you have a 20% chance of living. The doctor can say, well, actually, no, I wouldn't be surprised, or yeah, I'd be really surprised. And generally speaking, honestly, from my experiences, doctors have a fairly good intuition, and they frequently don't tell patients if they think the patient has only 3 months to live. They keep focusing on the treatment. But this is a non-threatening way to ask the question. Yeah.
I took my dad to the doctor near the end of his life, and he wasn't very well. He had congestive heart failure. And we went through the checkup or whatever he was there for. And as we were leaving, the doctor says very casually, as he's opening the door to leave the office, the doctor said, well, Harold, how long are you going to live? He said this to my father, and my father said, well, think about 6 months. And he said, oh, do you have something coming up? You know, some special occasion? And my dad said, no. I don't have no idea why my dad said 6 months, but 3 months later, he was dead. And I just think the doctor wanted to, my guess is, see if my dad realized where he was, in that winding down process, you know. But it was really cool, the casual way he did it.
Yeah.
He was a doctor that dealt with older people.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that can't be overemphasized is the importance of everyone involved knowing where that health director is.
This
is huge. A horrendous thing happened with one of my friend's father, who was in a bad car accident in his 80s, the whole family knew what he wanted and what he didn't want, but they couldn't find the directives.
This is huge. And
honored in the teaching hospital.
Medicine, no, in any hospital will do everything if that document can't be found.
Right.
This is a problem. My uncle, who died recently, he had an advanced directive, he didn't want anything done, he was 88, he was in a nursing home, he fell. They sent him off to the hospital, he had a heart attack in the ER, they intubated him, they put him on a ventilator, he was in the intensive care unit. 24 hours later, they reached his doctor, who said, oh, he didn't want anything done. So they pulled it all and he died. This is, even nursing homes don't, you really, that's why I love this pulse thing that goes with the patient, because that's your better bet, but yeah.
Early on you said things change, and you're right, they change by the hour and sometimes by the minute.
Yes.
I was a paramedic on the fire department, and we got called to a nursing home where somebody had a DNR, but the family had come to visit from out of town because they had been told if dad's going, you better get her quick. So why did you call us? Well, Dad needs to go to the hospital. He's really sick.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So transferring from his bed to the stretcher, he arrested. So, okay, you got a DNR. No, you got to save our dad.
Yeah.
And the rest of the family wasn't there to say, hey, wait a minute. And by the time the rest of the family got there, we had intubated him and cardioverted him a dozen times. And the people that wanted everything done, they're changing their mind now. Don't do this. You're hurting our dad. Don't hurt our dad. Holy cow.
Very common story.
Yes.
This is another thing that it takes courage to die well in the United States because you have to say no to hospitalizations.
Yep.
You have to say, no, I am not going there. Hospitalizations are not benign. And, you know, it's just we forget that, but they are not benign. And it is a routine and it is a system, and doctors, we are all trained to behave in a certain way, and it's automatic, and it happens. Just like with the medics, same thing. Yeah.
I have a friend, and she's an RN and worked in cardiac and ER and all that, and she says, after a certain age, I'm getting my tattoo, and it says, do not
resuscitate.
Yes, right there. She's seen exactly what you said. After a certain age, quality of life is, and if things become chronic, so that's my tattoo right there.
It's too bad you'd have to do that.
You'd have to do that.
Yeah.
I saw one of the chapters in the handbook of mortals was hastening death. Do you have anything to tell us about that?
I'm sorry, it was what?
Hastening death.
Well, so the reason that our ethics committee got into this is because the Washington State passed a death with dignity law, which allows physicians with, there's a lot of criteria to prescribe medications that hasten death. Personally, I would not do that. And I don't think Minnesota or Iowa have that. Oregon does. What we've learned is that when those laws are passed, like it was in Oregon quite a few years ago, even people who go through all the steps and get the prescriptions usually don't take them. And we've also learned that in Oregon, it triggered a much more focused look at end-of-life care. And I think it's doing that in Washington. I personally think that's a response to the failure in medicine's part to give control to patients. I think the control is all in the technology, and that people want to take control back with death and dying, and that's their way of doing it. But there are healthier ways, I think, for the family and the patient.
We had a friend who had a gene for breast cancer. Her sister died of it. Two of her daughters died of it. The other daughter had it. She had a mammogram, and a ovarectomy, and she had cancer, and she had good treatment, and she managed very well for a long time. But suddenly she had very painful metastases to the brain, and she decided she wasn't going to go on with it. She went into hospice. They put in an IV, and her daughter sat there and gave her a shot of a little morphine every 20 minutes for a week. She had no fluids or food, anything like that. She died in a week. She was conscious able to respond for about a day, and after that, she was goodbye.
But that's a different thing. And that you can, hastening death, the Indians, my grandmother, just stopped eating. That's what the Indians did. That's a great way to die. That's a painless way to die. Again, your kidneys shut down, your potassium level goes up. Nature's gift to us, dying isn't always have to be painful. Even natural death does not have to be painful. And many people do. That all the stories you hear about, he waited until the sister came from Bali. I think we have more control over it than we know. Yeah. Well, I'm just going to close here. I wanted to read a couple of things. This is a poem called Deepening the Wonder. Death is a favor to us, but our scales have lost their balance. The impermanence of the body should give us great clarity, deepening the wonder in our senses and eyes of this mysterious existence we share,
and are surely just traveling through. If I were in the tavern tonight, Hafiz would call for drinks, and as the master poured, I would be reminded that all I know of life and myself is that we are just a mid-air flight of golden wine between his pitcher and his cup. If I were in the tavern tonight, I would buy freely for everyone in this world, because our marriage with the cruel beauty of time and space cannot endure very long. Death is a favor to us, but our minds have lost their balance. The miraculous existence and impermanence of form always makes the illumined ones laugh and sing. 14th century. I love that. My sister, who's had breast cancer twice, sent that to me. And finally, for me, to live is Christ and to die is gain. That's Paul from one of the epistles. So thank you very much, everybody.